Okay. We're aware that several of our members are presenting bills in other committees or are sitting in other committees also. And so we are going to get started while we wait for a quorum to check in. And we're going to start with Senator Johnson because she has a very quick bill that's a department bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing us first. I'm presenting Senate File 1193, which is a department bill. It's a technical bill. It's basically just keeping up to federal codes, and I have Mark Bocelli from the department to talk about it.
Okay. Mr. Bocelli.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. This bill is basically a housekeeping bill that under statutes 239 for weights and measures. And if you look through it there, what we're going to do is adopt the newest versions of ASTM specifications. And we also are amending a few items here if you look through it. I don't know if you want to go through each line by line, but
Just the items that pertain really to this division. I think they have to do probably with the definitions of the biodiesel fuel.
Yeah, and that's one of the additions is a biodiesel definition, and that is from NIST Handbook 130. That's a uniform definition for the entire country to use.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Do we have the amendment in front of us, A3 amendment?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, the amendment isn't going to be presented here today. I was approached by the folks that are working on that, and they're not ready to present
okay.
yet.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is that it, Senator Johnson?
Yes, Madam Chair.
I think what we're going to do is wait until one more member. He enters to save the day. Senator Jungbar. Okay, somebody care to make a motion then?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'd like to move that Senate File 1193 be recommended to pass and
transportation.
And referred to transportation.
Okay. Any discussion? Then on Senator Rosen's motion, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed?
Thank you, committee
Bill
members.
Passes. Thank you, Senator Johnson.
Yes,
Senator Kubley.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd like to note that a quorum did occur before the vote. Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1635 deals with a change in the number of megawatts of energy that can be generated by school districts, and with me today is Superintendent Ted Suss from the Wabasso School District. Thank you. He prompted me on that one. I'll let him address the committee, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee. 14 Minnesota school districts.
Just give your name for the record, please.
It's Ted Suss, S-U-S-S.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Suss.
Thank you. Superintendent of Schools in Wabasso, Minnesota. 14 Minnesota school districts applied for and received authorization to issue clean renewable energy bonds by the IRS. We each received $3 million in authorization. That occurred in November of last year. The 14 districts, and I'll just real quickly read the names, Brainerd, Chisago Lakes, Edgerton, Elk River, Faribault, Hastings, New Prague, Northfield, St. Peter, Truman, Wabasso, Watertown, Mayor, Winona, and Zambruda, Mazeppa. So they're scattered pretty much across the state. Those 14 districts have formed a joint powers entity, a cooperative under the joint powers laws of the state. We actually had our formation meeting just on March 5th. We are in the process of conducting a feasibility study at the present time to construct a wind farm rather than each district building a wind tower or wind towers in the backyard by our football field. We're going to do a single wind farm somewhere in Minnesota, probably in southwestern Minnesota, but that's under study at the present time. The CREB bonds that I referenced, which were created by the Federal Energy Bill passed in the summer of 2005, must be sold by December 31st, 2007. As I said, we are in the midst of this feasibility study where we will identify the location, the interconnection to the grid, the power purchase agreement from the energy company, purchase the turbines, all of those things. At this point, it appears that the $3.3 million limit may be a barrier, $3.3 meg limit may, in fact, stand in the way of us developing the maximum size farm that our financing will allow us to develop. There are about three reasons why the limitation may be a problem. One is, as we look at sites, the sites generally are sized for the wind capacity that's available, 40 meg, 50 meg, 100 meg, 300 meg. Secondly, obviously, the larger the wind farm, the better we do on economies of scale. If we have to build a substation, it's obviously going to be better to build a substation for 60 meg than for 30 meg. And then thirdly, some of our member districts are in communities where there is an interest in a community project. Northfield, for example, there's a strong interest in a community wind project in Northfield. If we develop our project and use up the district's entire 3.3 meg capacity authorization, that school district would be prohibited from participating in that local project. So increasing from 3.3 to 10 would eliminate those barriers. We are not likely to build 10 meg of generating capacity per district, but there's a pretty high probability that we would find it possible to go beyond the 3.3. No cost to the state on this. I believe it's a good public policy to have school districts involved in this, generate revenue to help offset the cost of education, and be happy to answer any questions.
So, Mr. Suss, what do you intend to do with the energy you create?
We will sell the energy into the grid through a power purchase agreement with an electric utility company. And as far as which electric utility company, that's something that is determined largely by the location of the farm, you know, whose lines are nearby, who's willing to buy it. But that's all part of the feasibility study that's going on as we meet today.
Many of the school districts today are struggling just to pay their operating costs and to keep their buildings up to date. I'm wondering how you come up with the capital to be able to invest in something like this.
The primary source, if not the entire source, will be the sale of these clean, renewable energy bonds. We will have either a performance agreement with a developer or business risk policy, insurance policies, to assure that there is no possibility that any part of the cost of this project would come back onto the school district. The developer with whom we're working right now is Johnson Controls Incorporated, which is a multi-million dollar international corporation that has signed performance contracts with many Minnesota school districts for everything from building renovation to new construction.
And do you use any of the energy produced to run your facilities?
We would not directly use any of the energy, as we would sell it into the grid, and then, of course, we buy back from the grid. The economies of building separate site towers are just not as good as a single site because of maintenance costs, construction costs, and the ability to get the power sold to the electric grid.
Okay. How much profit do you expect to make off of such an endeavor?
Again, that's something that's being determined with the feasibility studies that are ongoing right now. A very similar sized wind farm to the one that we anticipate would show that each district would have an annual return of anywhere from about $10,000 to $25,000 per year during the 16 years while we're retiring the Krebs indebtedness. And then once those bonds are retired, the revenue could range as high as $80,000 to $100,000 per year per district. But again, until the feasibility study is completed, we don't have financial data that tell us precisely what the return will be. Our agreement with Johnson Controls is that unless they can bring us a project which shows a positive cash flow each year and the ability to retire the indebtedness during those 16 years, we have no obligation to go forward and we have no obligation to pay any development costs.
And will you be paying taxes on this?
That's a good question. I'm not that knowledgeable on the all the whys and wherefores of the project. My expectation is because it's a profit-generating or a revenue-generating function that the wind farm will be subject to tax, same as if we were to own real estate, that we, say a farm that we rented out.
This is entirely new concept to me, and I'm wondering if there is any other type of a project that school districts get involved in that might be similar.
Look, the current law, Madam Chair, authorizes school districts to construct up to 3.3 meg of generating capacity, and there are several school districts that do have towers that feed into the grid and generate revenue. So that part of it's not a new concept. The idea of multiple districts going together and owning a wind farm would be a new concept, but I don't see it as being that different from if we were to build one in our backyard.
Well, I understand that it is in current law up to 3.3 megawatts, but what I question is the public policy of a school getting into competition with the private sector. And I'm wondering what was the premise behind the 3.3 megawatts and whether or not I thought that this would be for educational purposes to sort of like, environmental trails and
sure.
Nature trails and things like that, things that would be used by the school to teach the students and rather than to make a profit by the school.
Madam Chair, there is a provision in the law that requires a curriculum to be associated with this, and we, in fact, do have a curriculum that largely developed. A couple of school districts are test implementing it this school year, and that will continue. I guess I don't see that, the competition with other generators, this very body passed legislation very recently requiring a much higher amount of renewable energy to be purchased by the power utilities. And from what people who talk to me are saying, they're scrambling to find sources of energy, and this would be a source. School districts across the state own buildings that they rent. There are many for-profit businesses run by school districts. There are hardware store, grocery store, some manufacturing, generally involving students in a labor or management. This would not be greatly different, however, from a school district owning a building and renting it out for anything from retail to office space, and that's something that occurs now.
Okay. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent, if I do my math right, which is questionable, I figure a consortium of 14 school districts at the 3.3, you could have generated a little over 46 megawatts of power. And that would be approximately 20 towers if they're the 2.5 megawatt. So this way you could generate 140 megawatts, which would be a little over 50, maybe 55 towers. So it's going to be a substantial investment.
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't believe that our group would ever contemplate that large of a wind farm. I think our main concern is if we're looking at a site that is suitable for 60 meg of capacity, and we're limited to 46.2, and your math is correct, that would preclude us from using that site because we would not be able to fully develop the site, and it wouldn't be economically feasible for us to, you know, lease that site. The 10 meg is an arbitrary number. I mean, I actually didn't suggest the 10 meg figure. I'm told, and I don't have any factual data to back this up, that at the time the bill was originally passed, or the law was originally enacted, the largest turbine available was a 1.65 meg turbine, and 3.3 were two turbines. I don't know if that's true or not. I was told on Monday by a wind expert that the largest turbine available in the world now is a 5 meg turbine manufactured by a German company. I have no clue how big that must be, but if you look at the 2.2s and the, I think there's some 3.1s available in this country, you know, the turbine head's as big as this room. But the 10 meg figure was probably picked as much to accommodate improvement in technology as anything else. For our uses, if we ever got beyond 5 or 6, I think that would be way beyond where we would go. I do want to stress the point I made that if we utilize our full capacity, it does prevent a school district from joining in with another local, it might be a local consortium that wants to build a small wind farm in the community. And if we use the full 3.3, they would have no authorization under law to engage in that or join in that project.
Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess either one of you could answer this. I'm having a hard time understanding. Would the wind-generated power first be used to power school buildings, and then the balance sold, or is this just to be put up with the idea of generating some money to offset some of the bills from the district?
Mr. Sess.
The power would be sold directly into the grid. I look at it, I think my colleagues look at it, as that's offsetting our energy costs in our district. If we built a tower, behind the school by the football field, we could run that into the building and sell the excess. But the economies of building a wind farm versus building the scattered site are much better. So although I see it as we are generating our own electricity, technically we're selling it to the power companies and we're buying power back from the power companies.
Senator Jungbar.
Madam Chair, I guess on that note, I'm definitely in agreement with you in terms of I think we've got to decide as a committee and as a legislature if we do want our school districts, our counties, our cities to be going into competition with the rest of private industry. I have no problem setting up an individual unit on the grounds and, using the power and then piping and selling back the excess. I do have a problem with setting something up and going into competition with private business.
Mr. Suss does make an argument for being able to offset some of the education costs. And I raise it primarily as this is public policy that we probably should address. But I question whether or not 10 megawatts are necessary. And, I question whether the 10 megawatts. My question was how many other school districts also have or have plans to develop wind energy?
I have heard from probably 6 to 10 districts that are actively involved in developing and wondering if they could join our entity. I don't know how many other districts might be contemplating generating capacity.
How many school districts are there?
I used to know that right to the month. It's about 325, 350. I used to know that number, but I've lost track of it. What did you say the number was?
387 is what Senator Olson
strikes me a bit higher
said
than I thought it was. But
maybe that is high.
For years it was 427, but that was before the last wave of consolidation. It's in the mid-300s.
And so the any school district that was interested would have to join this consortium?
No,
they could develop.
They can do it totally on their own. This is just something we put together to take advantage of the fact that we all have the same financing instrument. The Federal Energy Bill authorized the sale of $800 million in these clean renewable energy bonds and specified that a certain percentage of them had to go to public entities like school districts and local units of government. You know, back to the point of competing with private, you know, we would be selling our electricity to the electrical grid system, the same as any local energy producer. And as far as I know, we would be subject to the same taxation treatment as Mr. Joe Blow Farmer or a collection of investors who decide to build a wind farm. I'm not aware of any special tax treatment we'd receive.
Any further questions by committee members?
Yeah. And as far as the 10 meg, you know, I think initially my request was 6.
So you anticipate paying property taxes?
I anticipate we would pay property taxes because I know that we as a school district, if we owned a piece of real estate and we rented, say it was farmland where we anticipated building a school building, we would pay real estate taxes on that. If we owned it and it was held strictly for educational purposes, we wouldn't. So my expectation has been from day one that we would pay the same taxes as if a group of private investors went together and built a wind farm.
Sales taxes and personal property taxes?
Again, I'm not aware that we would have any special tax treatment. We would pay sales tax on the materials we'd buy to construct to the same extent that anybody else would, just as we do when we build a school building.
Okay. Madam Chair. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Senator Kubley and your witness. I certainly am not opposed to it. I think, obviously, our job in this division is to kind of focus on the energy implications, but going back to some of my time that I served on Senator Stump's K-12 budget division, my only fear would be if School District A is allowed to have some of these turbines and have increased revenue. Obviously, we fight for equalization here and we have sparsity issues, and School District B can't take advantage of it. I just don't know if, I mean, that's maybe something that this committee can't deal with, but certainly I think that that would be something. I mean, is that something that we have to be concerned about?
The law,
Mr. Suss.
The law applies to every school district in the state, and this change would apply to every school district in the state. So that, I don't think, would be a problem. If we were asking for extra authority to do something that other districts were not allowed to do, that clearly would be a problem of allowing some districts to have access to revenue that others could not.
Okay, sir. Madam Chair. I think that
Senator
helps a little
Sparks.
Bit, but again, obviously, Senator Kubley and myself and Senator Senjum represent districts that have a lot of wind potential, but my fear would be for some of the other areas that maybe don't have that same opportunity. And again, that's something that's probably bigger than this committee needs to deal with, but I think it's something that needs to be thought about a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any further discussion? Are there people in the audience who would like to speak either for or against this bill? Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, I would recommend that Senate File 1630.
Just a minute.
Okay.
What I'm going to recommend is that we lay this over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. So you may make that recommendation.
I will make that
motion.
And okay. In a comment, if I may.
Yes.
For Senator Sparks, Chisago Lake School District, which is in my district, is part of the consortium. So it seems that districts from all over can kind of buy into the western wind.
And Madam Chair, for Senator Sparks' information, one of the sites that we have had recommended to us is in Maurer County. I don't know exactly where, but it's in Maurer County.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Senjum.
Just a thought, and I think I at least look to school districts to do education, and they do it in fabulous sorts of ways, but You know, it seems like there's people that ought to run schools and there's people that ought to run wind farms. And I'm not sure they're the same people.
Okay. Senator Carlson?
Yeah. Madam Chair, I guess I would echo what Senator Sinjum said. It seems to me that you're going to have to hire a staff to run something like this and probably incorporate. You're going to have accountants. You're going to have maintenance. And I'm not sure if we're talking about Johnson Controls actually operating everything, and then what is their cut of the proceeds, and will they get it off the top, and will they guarantee you a certain outcome? It seems to me to be pretty risky for a school district.
Madam Chair, Senator, these are many of the same questions that we asked. In forming this joint powers entity, all 14 school boards, local elected boards of education, had to approve the joint powers agreement. And believe me, at 6 or 7 board members per district times 14, these questions got asked. We definitely will have an agreement with an operator. Whether or not it's Johnson Controls, that remains to be seen as we move forward with the feasibility studies and the development of the project. The developers, the operators of the wind farms typically, as I understand it, get a slice off the top. You know, the power purchase agreement generates a certain amount of money. They have a fee, and the remainder is used to reimburse the investors. So the expectation is not that the school district is going to be involved in running a wind farm, by no means whatsoever. It will be a professional company that does that for a living. We would be an owner, just as we now are, you know, owners of other pieces of property.
Well, I think we've now got a series of other questions. So, Senator Koch, did you have a question?
No, Madam Chair, I think Senator Carlson and Senator Sinjum had said what I had to say.
Okay, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Suss, maybe you spoke about this earlier, but in your study and in this joint powers group that's doing this study, is there a break-even point as far as your investment to when you're going to see, you know, a return? How long is it going to take to reach that break-even point?
Mr.
Chairman, Senator, and I forgot to answer one of Mr. Carlson's questions. It's very closely related to that. Johnson Controls has offered to construct this under a performance contract. We will decide whether or not that's the most advisable way to go once we see their proposal. It may be better to use a business risk insurance policy to guarantee the revenue rather than a performance contract, because they'll obviously take something to get that performance contract. In the process, I forgot your question, Senator.
About a break-even point.
Senator. The clean renewable energy bonds must have a maturity or a redemption date of 16 years. They have to be sold for 16 years according to IRS regulations. Our agreement with Johnson Controls at this point is that if they can bring us a proposal that shows a positive cash flow each year one being the day that the switch is turned on, through those 16 years, including retirement of the debt, then and only then would we go forward. And that would have to be guaranteed either by Johnson Controls or by some form of insurance. The aspect of risk is probably the issue that was of greatest concern to school boards. We do not have school district funds to put into a project such as this. We do not have school district funds to subsidize a project such as this if it weren't capable of carrying its own weight. So having those guarantees in place are vitally important. It probably does seem strange to have a school district operating, you know, wind energy generating capacity, but the fact of the matter is, and a couple of you have alluded to it, our budgets are tight, and every possible way we can find to generate revenue or hold down expenses is the business we're in.
The question is whether we open the floodgates. So, I mean, this is probably not a discussion we should have here, but should have in the education finance division about can school districts get involved in running hotels or grocery stores or or any other type of profitable enterprise. And then, as Senator Sparks raised the issue, what does that do for
equity?
Equity, yeah. Right.
It's a concern I share, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? My recommendation is that we move it at this point. If anybody'd like to make that motion, but that we move it without recommendation to the Education Finance Division. I think we'll lay it over for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Senator Olsen, you wish to make that recommendation?
Yes.
Okay. So Senator Olsen moves that Senate file 1635 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And for we haven't had this discussion, but this committee will be putting together an omnibus bill that will probably include things like seabed and global warming and projects like this. Okay. Any discussion about that motion? Then all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? That motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
They're telling us. School districts have got to be innovative.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair and fellow members, before you is Senate file 1449, which basically examines the 911 fees and provides a method to improve compliance of already existing statute. Right now, our current process relies upon voluntary compliance from the telephone industry, and the commissioner lacks authority to verify these council reports. So basically, this legislation, Senate File 1449, would require sworn declaration of the fees and examination process for better management and the collection of revenue from all vendors, including emerging technology. And Madam Chair, I do have the A1 amendment that I'd like to move.
Okay, and this is the first hearing on this bill, right?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, so Senator Rosen moves the A1 amendment, which puts it in the shape the author would like it to be.
Madam Chair, the A1 amendment just basically changes the word from audit to examination to be a little more sensitive.
Okay. Any discussion? Then on the A1 amendment, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have with me Mr. Ron Whitehead. He's the 911 program director from the Department of Public Safety.
Mr. Whitehead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Rosen, thank you for this opportunity. As said by Senator Rosen, it's essentially a procedural change, and I will note that we collect not only the 911 fee, but we also collect the TAP fee and the TAM fee on behalf of the Department of Commerce and on behalf of the Public Utilities Commission. This change obviously has some impact because of changing technology. ILEX and CLEX, which were regulated by the PUC, we do have a vehicle where we could in some manner verify compliance with the fee submission. When we move to wireless and then move to VoIP providers, they aren't regulated by the PUC. Now, in the case of VoIP, I will note that in June of 2005, the FCC did require them to connect to the 911 network and did also include some language indicating that they have to provide or contribute to the cost of the network. So they're supposed to pay fees, but they're a bit more difficult to get at, given the fact that the PUC and the Department of Commerce doesn't have jurisdiction over them. So this language essentially provides the commissioner with the opportunity to request verification of fees if there is no response, to actually attempt to try to collect the fees, and if they do respond, to verify those fees so that we can treat all telecommunication providers equally. That's if there's nothing else you hear from the telecommunication providers, it is technology neutrality. Treat them all the same, and that's exactly what we're trying to do with this procedural change to the law.
Mr. Whitehead, do you have any idea how many are not paying the fees?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, probably the biggest one, Vonage, is in fact paying us fees at this point in time. We're not sure. There's smaller providers that are going through. There's essentially three different competitive local exchanges that are providing gateway services for VoIP providers. And each of them have indicated they've got a small number of customers there. We can actually go to the database and find out how many names they've got in the database. So we do have some way of verifying from our side what should be the customer count. So we're in the process of beefing up that process. I can't give you a number. What I can tell you is one of the biggest ones, Vonage, is in fact contributing fees and has been doing that for about 9 months.
Okay. Questions or discussion? Anybody in the audience that wishes to speak on this bill? Okay, then Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, we haven't had too many telecom bills.
No, I was just thinking about that.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 1449 be laid over for possible inclusion.
No, this one you can pass, but it needs to go to Public Safety Budget Division.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move that it goes be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Thank you.
Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So on Senator Rosen's motion that Senate File 1449 be recommended to pass and re-referred to finance, Senator Dibble.
I'm sure just kind of easing us into the telecom portion.
We had one previous bill.
Oh, okay. That's
Senator
right.
Latz.
No. Yeah, Senator Latz. That's right, correct. That's right.
Our second little baby step here. Hold on, everyone. Here we go.
Just the non-controversial ones. Next year will be telecom.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
All right. We'll have fun with that.
We'll give the utilities a break next year.
All right.
any further discussion? Then on the motion, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed?
Thank you, Madam.
Motion adopted.
Thank you,
members.
Thank you. Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair and members, I'm before you today with Senate File 1902, which is an agency bill, and I have Tim Morris who will give you the update on the bill.
Okay, Mr. Morris.
My name is Tim Morris. I work with the Department of Administration. I'm the director of the Travel Management Division. Forward pricing is the ability to lock in a price for fuel today, which you plan to buy in future weeks and months. In current statute, state agencies are allowed to use this tool for fuel used for buildings and facilities. What this change is allowing the state agencies to use this tool also for transportation fuel for operations, which is transportation, which would be primarily diesel fuel, possibly gasoline used in state vehicles for transportation.
So this would be for the entire state fleet?
This would allow the state agency's right to use this tool to buy transportation fuel. Primarily, the intent is to use it for the bulk fuel that the state purchases. The state purchases probably 7.5 million gallons of fuel, but about 2 million gallons of fuel is purchased in bulk. The rest of it is purchased in retail at retail stations throughout the state.
Okay. Any questions or comments by committee members? Anybody in the audience that wishes to address this committee on this bill? Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, I would ask that this be considered in, does it have to go anywhere?
Judiciary.
Yes, it has to go state and local government operations. I'm assuming that you're anticipating some savings to the state as a result of this.
We're not, and we're actually, thank you, Madam Chair, we're not anticipating savings. We're anticipating using this as a budget risk reduction tool. You can lock in the price of fuel, and it helps insulate against price spikes. Typically, there isn't a lot of savings or costs to it, but it helps you with your budget when there's a price spike.
Okay. Senator Olsen.
With that, Madam Chair, I would request that Senate File 1902 be passed and go on to state and local government.
Okay. Then on Senator Olsen's motion, any questions or comments? Then on the motion, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senator Anderson.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1857 is some amendments to the cold weather rule. And because of the changes to the schedule today, I just got here, unfortunately, so I apologize for not being here earlier. And my witness is on his way. So I will do my best. Ron Elwood is my witness from the Legal Services Advocacy Project. And he knows this far better than I do. So I will do my best to go through the provisions of the bill. Anyway, it's related to the cold weather rule, and we propose some amendments to the cold weather rule. And members, I'm sure most of you are familiar with our law that's been on the books for many years that protects people from their heat being disconnected, or their electricity from being disconnected between October 15th and April 15th. Or I guess it just applies to heating primarily. The amendments that we make affect investor-owned utilities. They clarify that reconnections as well as disconnections are covered. We also do not require but allow customers to make monthly payments of greater than 10% of household income, which is the current cap under the law. We allow changes to payment agreements if a customer's circumstances change. We give utilities more options to verify income eligibility of customers applying for cold weather rule protection. And additional prohibitions on disconnection are added into the law, which means no disconnects will be allowed while a complaint is currently pending with the Public Utilities Commission. No disconnections can be made on a Friday unless there's contact with the customer and an payment agreement offer, an offer to work out a payment agreement on a Friday so that someone won't be disconnected and then have no recourse until the weekend is over. No disconnects on Saturday, Sunday, the holidays, or the day before a holiday. And I think a couple of years ago there were some issues with disconnections right around Christmas time, and that was pretty traumatic for some people. No disconnects when offices are closed or no one is available to negotiate a payment agreement. And so it just makes it more workable so that consumers will be protected. This bill also moves many PUC rules into statute, such as the appeal process, and it establishes an early identification program to find customers who are disconnected prior to the winter. And this is something that a number of these provisions, but that are things that we talked about in last year's energy bill, and a number of the provisions are the same or similar, I think, to what were in last year's omnibus energy bill, the one that was died an unfortunate death because of unrelated circumstances. There were a number of bills last year that just sort of never made it through the entire process in the House. Your timing is great. and so we did include an early identification program in that bill. And what that says is that before October 15th, utilities must notify customers of cold weather rule protections and try to contact disconnected customers to encourage them to enter payment agreements and get reconnected. So once they are contacted by the utility, they have an opportunity to negotiate a plan so that they pay what they are able to keep their service connected. And that's what the law allows. So it requires effort on both sides, from on the utility side and the customer side. So I think it's a good agreement. And now I will turn it over to Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, what Senator Anderson said. thank you very much for the opportunity here to testify on this bill. I think that the important thing here is that we're making a lot of clarifications, not a lot, but there's some important clarifications in current law and adding a couple of things that Senator Anderson identified. The one thing I think I want to I need to add is that the Public Utilities Commission want to acknowledge their help on this bill, as well as all of the utilities in Minnesota. The investor owns were very, very helpful. Excuse me, I just ran over from the house, and I'm a little out of breath.
It had to be scary.
Okay. And, you know, there's an old expression, it's hard to be two places at once when you're nowhere at all. So the utilities have been extraordinarily helpful in working through the language on this bill. And the Public Utilities Commission as well, I want to acknowledge the staff over there. And I just do want to point out that the PUC has brought to our attention a number of issues that mostly of technical nature. They won't change any substance here. But we would ask the committee to pass the bill through today and allow us to discuss some of these technical matters with the commission and then come to the floor with a technical amendment. I think there is an oral amendment that we'll need to make, which is to change this to this.
Okay,
page 3, line 11.
I think change. Mr. Fuller can help you with the oral amendment.
Change. Change after the,
of the household.
Delete income. This and insert.
Okay. Does Mr. Fuller have it?
Yeah. Madam Chair, members,
yeah, pull your microphone.
Just read it. It's just one word change.
On page 3, line 11, it says customer's income. And you'll notice that right below it on line 13, it says household income, and that's what's used. So I think customer should be deleted and household should be inserted on page 3, line 11. And then there's one other one, which is simply stylistic, but if you turn to page 4, line 12, you'll notice that there's sort of a clause there ending with a colon. During the cold weather period, colon, if you look through, there's a bunch of paragraphs that aren't really separated by semicolon. So I would say before, during, insert, this subdivision applies, insert A, this subdivision applies during the cold weather period, delete the colon, insert a period.
Could you repeat? You know where we are.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it reads on line 12, A in a parens, this subdivision applies during the cold weather period, period. And then on line 13, change the A to B, renumber the clauses. And on line 16, change B to C. And on 32, change C to D. And on page 5, line 4, page D, change D to E, and then just an instruction to correct any references in that subdivision. I don't think there are any as I glance at it. So then it reads, it's grammatical, and it makes it clear that it applies only during the cold weather, which was what it was intended.
You understand that, Senator Anderson.
Mm-hmm. So, Madam Chair, I would move both of those oral amendments if I could.
Okay, does the committee understand the changes? Any discussion? Then on the amendment, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion adopted.
Madam Chair, I just want to say that Mr. Elwood has worked extremely hard with the utilities, and they've all worked really, really hard over a couple of years to work out these provisions, and I appreciate that cooperation very, very much.
Okay. Then on the bill, any questions or comments by committee members? In the audience, anybody that wishes to address the committee on the bill? Yes. Senator Sharon.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Anderson, I'm just reading through this trying to think about how it might apply if I was trying to hold on to my energy during a tough time. And under Subdivision 7, number 7, you know, where you're describing the prohibitions and requirements, and there can't be a disconnect when no utility personnel are available to resolve disputes, enter into payment agreements, or accept payments. And then earlier you're talking about, you know, or at some point about not the day before a holiday or something like that. I'm trying to think if it's a day before a holiday. I'm trying to make sure that that doesn't, when is this period of time that no personnel are available to resolve disputes? That seems open to interpretation to me. I mean, is it during business hours or?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I think normally we're talking nights and weekends and holidays are the problem, but you can, maybe Mr. Elwood can give some examples. Or.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, the idea I think was, the original crafting was during business hours, but business hours, and we could have defined it in between 9 and 5, but some maybe they're open until 5:30. And we decided rather than to put the hours of the day and a sort of an undefinable term, the concept was we want to make sure that there's always somebody available to call on the phone and say, okay, you know, how can we work this out? And I think that's exactly what that particular provision was intended to do, rather than put a days of the week, times of the day, and that's really all it is.
And Madam Chair, Senator Sharon,
Senator Anderson.
My basic grasp of the law is that, you know, the utilities cannot shut off your heat during that cold weather period, but they have to offer each person an opportunity to try to pay their bill and try to negotiate something. And so it's sort of that two-way responsibility. And so this requires that there be an opportunity to have that two-way communication. So if you're going to shut someone off because for not paying the bill, you have to do it at a time when they can. You can make that offer to them, and you can try to negotiate an agreement. Otherwise, you're not really living up to your obligation to keep the heat on.
Madam Chair,
Senator Sharon.
I think that that's the right outcome that we ought to be achieving. I'm just concerned if I'm working a 3 to 11 shift as a nurse. Or a midnight shift as a nurse, which I'm inclined to do. That's why normal business hours doesn't work. And you're talking about the industry's business hours, and I'm sort of talking about mine.
Uh-huh. Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, I understand what you're saying, but I would point out that another requirement here is pretty sufficient notice before the actual moment that the surface is cut. So somebody in that situation has a fair amount of prior notice that this is the day when it's going to happen. And, I mean, we're just trying to build in every possible opportunity for folks to get a payment agreement worked out and all that. And so I think this is about as much protection as we could figure to build in that was also fair to the companies.
Any other questions or comments by committee members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
So, Mr. Elwood, a customer would sit down at the office, the utilities office, and there is somebody that goes through their finances, their income, and figures out what would be appropriate for a monthly payment or what they could afford. I mean, are they going to, these utilities going to have to hire more people to handle?
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I think a lot of this takes place over the phone. And I don't think a whole lot of people come. Maybe in the municipal and co-op service territories, but this only applies to the investor owns. We did the co-op and munis a couple of weeks ago. But thanks to Senator Olsen. I think in the vast majority of the IOU cases, it's a phone conversation and negotiation, and folks say, well, here's what I can afford, and depending on the amount of the arrears and the amount of their usage, there's, you know, the idea is to get to a point where the folks can pay the maximum they can really afford and try to get the bill paid up and not have too much of a shortfall. But so it's kind of a negotiation. In fact, a couple of years ago, one of the improvements that we made to the bill was to really foster this negotiation, mutually acceptable kind of language that really made it a fairly equal and bargaining position from the customer saying, you know, here's legitimately what I can pay. So maybe there'll be some questions about, well, what's your income? What are your, you know, but they certainly could come to the office, but I don't think, to answer your question, that anybody's going to have to hire any more personnel.
Okay.
Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have any ideas to the additional costs this will have, if any? Has anybody discussed that?
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson. Again, this is current law, and this law has been on the books for many years, and the utilities have, been set up to abide by this law for a long time. So we're tweaking it and improving it, I don't know. The utilities could answer, but go ahead if they...
Mr. Elwood.
Yeah, they certainly can. But maybe I can answer your question simply.
Yeah.
Madam Chair and Senator Vanderveer, even though this looks like all new language and there is a new chapter of law encoded here, the reality is much of this is current law. A lot of this is current rule, which is simply being taken out of the rule books and put into the statutes. And so what Senator Anderson enumerated as the new things that we're doing are relatively few. So therefore, none of the utilities have indicated that there should be any cost. There certainly wouldn't be any cost to them to administer this, because it's essentially what they're doing already. You know, for example, adding the word reconnection, you know, arguably it was in the law in the first place, but we just wanted to make it absolutely unambiguous that people could get heat even if they didn't have it coming into the wintertime. Those things like that, and most of the companies are doing that anyway.
And Madam Chair, Senator Vanderveer, I would add to that a lot of the improvements to the law that we've worked on in the last couple of years have been in the spirit that, knowing that the experience in some other states is that when they have these kinds of plans worked out for that kind of mutual effort, utilities collect more unpaid bills. So they have less uncollectibles. That's been the experience of so I think it will help them collect more of those unpaid bills. You know, if you just cut somebody off, you're never going to see them again, and you won't get a penny from them. So this is actually, I think, a win-win.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Then I'll again ask the audience if there's anybody that wishes to address the committee on this. Okay.
All right.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 1857 as amended be recommended to pass, and it should be referred to the floor of the Senate.
Correct. Any questions or comments on Senator Anderson's motion that Senate File 1857 be recommended to pass? All those as amended and be referred to the floor, or referred to the floor. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Anderson. That brings us to the end of our hearing today, and we will not be meeting next week, primarily because of the floor sessions that we have, and so we will resume after our spring break. I would like to remind people, if I can find a message here, that there is a... former State Senator Steve Kelly and Gary Fields from the Blandon Foundation are bringing Matt Wenger, a Swedish telecom equipment provider and network telecommunication networks in Europe. Developer from PacketFront to discuss how PacketFront has developed the most innovative fiber optic telecommunications networks in Europe using an open network business model. And they will be meeting tomorrow on G21 at 8 o'clock. And everybody is welcome to come. And former Senator Steve Kelly brings some breakfast treats, I believe. So
all right.
Please join us tomorrow at 8, G21.
We might still be here with our transportation meeting.
Meeting's adjourned. And we made it by 5:30.